Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, the unscripted show that celebrates unsung heroes, myth busts historical lies, and rediscovers the forgotten stories that changed our world. I'm your host, Scott Rank. One of the most iconic people from the 20th century is Albert Einstein. He had his crazy hair, he's endlessly quotable, and he's recognized as one of the most iconic thinkers of all time. Now, if you know just a little bit about Einstein, I know that in 1905, he published a number of papers that basically laid the foundations of modern physics and completely changed views on space, time, mass, and energy. This was called the Annus Mirabilis Papers, from Latin, meaning extraordinary year. But Einstein didn't become an instant celebrity, and he had to overcome war, starvation, and international prejudice to do so. In today's episode, I'm speaking with author Matthew Stanley, author of the new book, Einstein's War, How Relativity Triumphed Amid the Vicious Nationalism of World War I. Einstein's celebrity was, in a large part, not his own doing. His ideas that changed physics forever were formulated during a time of worldwide crisis. Einstein was a victim of the Great War, even though, as a pacifist, he never held a rifle. Einstein was trapped behind enemy lines in Germany, he suffered from wartime starvation, and he couldn't communicate with his most trusted colleagues abroad. And as enemy lines were etched deeper, the worldwide scientific community became fractured and prejudiced, and German scientists were scorned by allies. And it was dangerous to try to communicate with anyone outside of Germany at this time. And Einstein was separated by his closest confidants by barbed wire and U-boats. What made it possible for Einstein's fame to spread and his theories to be accepted was the English Quaker astronomer A.S. Eddington. Despite the fact that other scientists seeking to confirm Einstein's ideas were being arrested as spies, Eddington believed in Einstein and his theories and risked everything to prove them true. This culminated in a 1919 expedition in which Eddington and other astronomers traveled around the world to try to catch a solar eclipse to prove Einstein's theory of relativity and that light has weight. It was the result of this expedition that made Einstein a worldwide celebrity. So we get into all these details in this discussion and talk about how bigotry and nationalism can be overcome by a search for the truth. So I hope you enjoyed this discussion with Matthew Stanley. Matthew, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Here's something right off the bat I was surprised by when I looked at your book, and that's that by the time of the Great War from 1914 to 1918, Einstein wasn't still an international celebrity. And I don't know a lot about Einstein, but I do know about 1905, what Wikipedia told me is called the Annus Mirabilis, the extraordinary year, where he basically lays down the foundation for all of modern day physics on space, time, mass, and energy. So how is he not an international celebrity at this point in the Great War?
Yeah, it's kind of a funny thing to think about. So the story of my book essentially picks up 10 years after his miracle year. So he publishes those papers in 1905 when he's still a patent clerk in Switzerland, so nobody knows who he is. But he gets those papers catch the eye of Max Planck, who's probably the most important scientist in Germany at the time. So some of Einstein's work in 1905 is clearly important. So things like molecular theory, the start of what we call quantum physics today. But relativity is not one of those things. That is, Einstein really cares about relativity. Most other people don't. So Einstein does get a professorship soon after 1905, and everybody's interested in his work on quantum theory and molecular theory. So he doesn't really get to work on relativity very much. So if you're one of the handful of people interested in radioactivity and quantum phenomena between 1905 and 1915, you would know who Einstein was. So that's, you know, a dozen people in Europe, maybe. But because he has Planck as a mentor and a supporter, Planck really feels deeply that Einstein has something super important to offer to the world. So he sets up Einstein with this great professorship in Berlin, where he can finally sit down and start thinking about relativity again.
And before we get up to the Great War, something you mentioned was that he faced headwinds because his theory was on track to debunk Isaac Newton's concept of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
Why was this a problem for people? Is it the sunk cost that physicists had invested their careers in one model and were therefore resistant to something? And I can totally believe the pettiness in academia. So is this the type of thing that's going on?
I think there's a lot of layers here. So one is, as you say, the sunk cost. That is, people had spent their entire careers studying Newtonian physics, learning how to use it, and there's not much reason to change that unless something really extraordinary comes along. It's because Newton's theory had passed sort of every test people had asked of it, right? It did so much that it wasn't obvious to people that an alternative was needed. And then there's, you know, social pressures too, is you want to do the same things that your teachers did and that your colleagues do. And it's not always professionally wise to invest in a new system that will mess with your old one.
Well, I have to give people holding on credit, because I've heard the quote of academia that the fights are so petty because the stakes are so small. That's especially in the humanities, but the stakes actually matter here. So I'd like to give them credit there. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, and it's there's an important sense in which Newton's theory is still really good today, right? 100 years after Einstein, we use Newton's calculations to put, you know, rovers on Mars, right? We don't use Einstein's theory to calculate the motions of spacecraft, even though we think it's true in a way that Newton's is not. The calculations are so much easier with Newton that we just don't bother. Right. We just use the old system.
I'm interested, the focus of your book during the Great War, when Einstein is cut off from the international scientific community. What does that look like to be cut off? Can academics not speak to each other? Is he marginalized for being a German? Is him being a Jew also have an influence on this? What does this look like?
Well, it's kind of hard to imagine in our sort of intensely networked era today, but when Einstein was cut off from international communication, that meant he didn't know what scientists were doing in England or France or America. He literally could not get journals from those countries. And similarly, when he finishes his equations in 1915, he can't share it with anyone other than his friends in Berlin, with one important exception, which is his friends in the Netherlands, which was neutral during the war. So he was allowed for at least a brief time to be able to go back and forth. So when he would go to the Netherlands, then he could catch up verbally with his friends there who did have some access to goings on in science in other countries. But that's the lifeblood of science, right? Is passing scientific papers back and forth. And he was cut off from that.
Well, the protagonist of your book is A.S. Eddington. So tell me about him. Where is he from? How does he connect with Einstein? And how does he play this role in helping to promulgate Einstein's theories?
He's an interesting character. So he's an astronomer and an astrophysicist. He studies the inside of stars, you know, how energy is produced in stars and things. But important for our story is that he's a Quaker, and it might not be obvious why that's important, but what that meant was he was a pacifist. So unlike most of his colleagues in England, he did not support the war, and he was really interested in maintaining science as an international thing. That is, he wanted to demonstrate how science could rise above kind of petty nationalism. So he gets brought into the story not because he knows Einstein. He's never met him before, and maybe he's only heard of him once. But rather, he, Eddington, and Einstein have a mutual friend in the Netherlands, a guy named Wilhelm de Sitter. And de Sitter decides, after one of Einstein's visits, to try and spread the word of relativity up to England. So he sends a letter. Eddington is the one who opens it. And Einstein's really, really lucky that Eddington is the one who opens this letter, because there's virtually no one in the country who's willing to think about German science, except for this strange pacifist.
And I'm curious, just in terms of how communication actually works at this time period, that letters could mm-hmm. be sent across enemy lines. Now, in my imagination, I know this is an oversimplification, I just imagine Germany completely surrounded by heavily dug-in trenches and barbed wire mm-hmm. and machine guns, mm-hmm. which it's not that simple. But what's communication like at this time across enemy lines?
Well, it's extremely limited, the answer. So at this time, speedy communication is done by telegraph. So before the war, there was actually this whole system set up for this kind of rapid distribution of scientific results via telegraph. And the center of that system was in Germany in a city called Kiel. And then as soon as the war begins, the British cut the telegraph lines. So all of a sudden, high-speed scientific communication is done. And they're not willing to send formal journal articles back and forth. So when Einstein wants to talk to his friends in the Netherlands about relativity, he has to write out by hand a physical letter and then give it, and then goes on a train and crosses the neutral border. And then his friends in the Netherlands who want to communicate with England, again, have to write out by hand and put the letter on a ship. But of course, this is the era of U-boats as well. So it's entirely possible that the ship carrying that physical letter would get torpedoed and just not arrive. And when they did arrive, sometimes it would be weeks or months later, right? So Einstein comes up with a new idea. It has to pass through the Netherlands and cross the U-boat blockade. It might be months before anyone hears about it.
Okay, well, that explains something that I was surprised to see at first in your book, where you note that despite the fact that other scientists seeking to confirm Einstein's ideas were being arrested as spies, Eddington believed in Einstein and his theories and was willing to risk everything to prove the truth. So at first mm-hmm. I thought, wow, why would just trying to validate objective science fact be considered spycraft? But was it the transmission of this information that made government authorities suspect what was going on?
Sometimes it was. So, for instance, there is an English scientist named Arthur Schuster who did research on radio, which was still, you know, a new and exciting topic at the time. And it was suspected, because he had studied in Germany at one point, that he was a spy, and he was using the radio to transmit information back and forth. But even beyond kind of physical things like owning a radio, people were suspicious of any kind of connection with Germany. So a German sounding name would be enough to make you a suspicious person. Having ever sent letters back and forth to Germany would mark you as an unreliable person. And scientists were actually, you know, removed from their positions and criticized in newspapers for thinking too much like a German.
I'm curious, can you think of modern day analogies? Would this be like a American and a North Korean scientist collaborating on particle physics? Or I don't know, what do you think this would look like today?
Yeah, I mean, I should say we have, if you're old enough, the Cold War had a lot of similarities to this. But even nowadays, so for instance, right now, the federal government is looking closely at American scientists who have ties to Iran and China. But those, you know, and what counts as a tie is often quite marginal, right? They're both on the same editorial board for a journal or something like that. Mm-hmm. So even today, we have this sort of suspicion that an American scientist isn't really reliable if they're too close to the folks that the government designates as enemies.
So how does Eddington promulgate Einstein's ideas? Does he mention it in journals? Is he reprinting the articles? What does that look like?
Well, so he's got a lot of work to do, is the short answer. So there is essentially nothing written about relativity in English. So the first thing he has to do is learn the theory himself, which is really hard to do unless you can talk to someone who already knows the theory, but he can't do that. And he doesn't even have access to Einstein's papers. He just has kind of the word that was passed on to him by their friends in the Netherlands. So it takes him about a year to understand the theory well enough to do anything with it. And then he publishes in scientific journals, and he gives presentations at scientific conferences and such. But more important is he kind of targets the public with this too. So he starts giving popular lectures and writes a short book kind of introducing people to relativity, because he doesn't just want to convince scientists that relativity is true. He wants to persuade the community as a whole, you know, the nation as a whole, that science should be an international thing, and that war is just causing these deep wounds to intellectual life.
What was his reception like? I could imagine angry people storming his public meetings saying, "You're collaborating with the Germans," or what was that like for him?
As far as I know, no one stormed his meetings, but there were definitely vicious public attacks in print from his colleagues very often, very angry at him for not supporting the war and pushing this, what they called enemy science at the time. So he not only had to deal with attacks from his colleagues about this, but he was also a conscientious objector to the war, meaning he refused to go fight even if he was going to be drafted. And that meant that he could be arrested and sent to prison too. So not only did he have sort of the professional stakes, but also deeply personal ones, right? It was entirely possible that he was going to lose his freedom by defending this sort of stuff.
Well, the triumph, so to speak, of Eddington and Einstein, which I think I have heard of, is the eclipse of 1919, which helps to establish relativity by viewing a solar eclipse. And this story helps explain why that was so important and so risky. So can you tell me about the eclipse of 1919 and the events leading up to that for Eddington to try to use this event to prove relativity?
So one of the predictions that Einstein makes in his theory of general relativity is that gravity can bend light. And you would see this happen only in really extraordinary circumstances. So you need something huge like the sun that has really powerful gravity. And then if you look at the image of a star right near the edge of the sun, the star's image would appear to be distorted in this very particular way that Einstein predicted. So you can go and look for that and then decide whether or not relativity is true based on that observation. The problem, of course, is that the sun is bright, so you can't usually see stars during daytime. So you have to wait for a total solar eclipse. And those are rare, right? They don't happen very often, and they happen in inconvenient parts of the world, too. So Einstein had been trying to get someone to do this test for years by this point, but he had no luck. And during the war, since Germany was blockaded, it was totally impossible. But Eddington takes the project on his own. That is, he decides that this is a thing he is going to do. So he has to marshal support. Fortunately, his friend is a guy named Frank Dyson, the Astronomer Royal, the most important astronomer in England. And that gets him the money he needs and kind of the material support. And the next eclipse that was coming up after these events was in May of 1919, as you say, and it would only be visible in the southern hemisphere. So Eddington has to get a team together, and they gather up their telescopes and their cameras, and they travel several thousand miles on shipping that is just recovering from the end of the war. You know, they've been starving in England, and suddenly they find themselves on this little rock off the west coast of Africa where they're going to do the test, and they have to essentially set up an observatory in the middle of the jungle and wait for this 1 6-minute period during the eclipse and take photographs during that moment. The weather almost ruins the whole thing. They're almost stranded because of a shipping strike. But they eventually take these photographs, these precious photographs, back to England and spend months measuring and calculating based on those results. So it actually isn't until November, right, 6 months after the actual eclipse, that they're ready to announce that the results actually do support Einstein's prediction.
And what was the reception when this is finally published?
Well, this is an interesting thing. So Eddington worked hard before the expedition to kind of set things up so he would get the best reception possible. So he and his friend Dyson had been talking to reporters and newspapers and magazines to get everyone excited ahead of time about the results so that when they finally did come back, people would be sort of champing at the bit to hear what was ready to go. And I should say it worked. So the day after they announced the results, it's on the front page of the Times of London. The next day, it's on the New York Times. And the headlines are extraordinary. A revolution in science, Einstein versus Newton, lights askew in the heavens. And Eddington is sort of primed and ready to go. So he's got popular lectures. He's writing articles. He does everything he can to get everybody excited about this new theory. And because of this sort of careful preparation, Einstein goes from obscurity to most famous person in the world essentially overnight.
And at that point, is his, I suppose, Germanness forgiven by the Allied side from World War One?
It is, in a weird sense, Eddington emphasizes it, right? Because Eddington wants this to be a great moment for scientific internationalism. So Eddington really hits the national issues to stress how extraordinary it is that English and German science come together in this way right after the end of the war. And this is, again, one of the reasons that Einstein becomes so famous so quickly, is that he becomes a symbol of this kind of rapprochement after the end of the war.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
This episode is brought to you by Calitrin. Text the word unplugged to 30605, and I'll send you a link to a wonderful product that can help you finally succeed in shedding that extra weight. I took Calitrin for several weeks last year, and I felt great in several ways. I felt stronger, my workouts felt easier, I slept better, I was noticeably trimmer, there was no downside. Text the word unplugged to 30605 right now to see this week's special offer on Calitrin. Calitrin contains collagen, the most abundant protein naturally occurring in the human body, which decreases as we age. Taking Calitrin promotes better sleep, more energy, less joint pain, and best of all, weight loss. Calitrin has an 86% success rate with their 90-day supply, and this week, take advantage of my special offer. Buy the 90-day supply and get an extra month free, plus free shipping. Ordering is easy. Just text the word unplugged to 30605, and I'll send you a link to the special offer. Again, text unplugged to 30605.
And it's interesting, I never think about this in terms of Einstein's biography. I think about him in World War II and talking about the theoretical aspects of the atomic bomb, writing to Roosevelt, being in the United States. Do you have any sense of his World War I experiences shaping how much he supported the Allies during World War II?
So this is actually this is an interesting kind of turnaround for Einstein. So during World War One, Einstein's a dedicated pacifist. He thinks the war is a terrible thing, nationalism is a terrible thing, and he does everything he can to stop the war and prevent future wars from happening. And he sort of lays the blame for the war on nationalism and patriotism kind of as an idea. But then after the war, eventually he stays in Germany and the Nazis come to power, and eventually Einstein is chased from his home, almost literally, and he ends up in the United States. And he's not alone in that. So there's actually this large group of refugee scientists that flee the Nazis and the other fascist powers in the 1930s. And a lot of them end up in the United States. And that group, having seen the Nazis up close, are terrified of what Hitler might be able to do. And Einstein is one of them, and he's worried that he knows that an atomic bomb is a possible thing, and he's desperately worried that the Nazis will get it first. So he puts aside all of his pacifism, all of his commitment to stopping war, to spur FDR to start building the atomic bomb, because the Nazis are, what Hitler could do with it is such a terrifying prospect. And it's sort of one of the great moral moments of Einstein's life, is he has to choose what's more important to him, pacifism or making sure the Nazis don't win the war. And he chooses the latter. But then after the war, he sort of realizes what he has unleashed and rededicates himself to pacifism. Again, he works for world government. He works for nuclear disarmament. It's really a fascinating kind of arc to his character.
And what happened to Eddington after 1919?
He becomes very well known in the English-speaking world, partially because of his connection to Einstein. But more, he becomes one of the great science popularizers of the day. So he writes a whole series of popular science books explaining relativity and quantum physics and the nature of the universe. He's also one of the first scientists to work closely with the BBC on their new radio science pieces, so he comes right into people's homes, as it were. So he ends up getting knighted, and he gets the Order of Merit, largely because he's able to explain the new science to the popular world. And in addition to just being good at explaining science, people call him one of the most reassuring thinkers, because he wants to tell people that just because they live in a world of relativity and quantum physics doesn't mean that they have to give up the way they've thought about free will and religious belief and kind of traditional structures of the world.
So he's sort of an early 20th century Stephen Hawking, Neil deGrasse Tyson type of person.
Exactly. Yep, that's right.
All right. Well, yeah, thank you for sharing all this with us. What would you think in this story is the message that you would like readers to take from your book?
Well, there's a bunch, but I think one of them is that science is messy and difficult. And I think that's important, because we often want to tell stories about science in which everything is always clear and easy, right? Einstein just sat down, wrote the equations, people recognized they were right, and he was celebrated as a genius. But in fact, it takes 10 years of struggle in which he desperately needs his friends and his allies to even make sense of his own theory. And then another 4 years after that, before he can convince people it is true, that it takes a lot of effort to make a scientific idea real. And we like to kind of delete that so the story seems easier and clearer. But in fact, it's okay that it takes work and controversy to convince people about scientific ideas.
Well, Matthew, your book is Einstein's War, How Relativity Triumphed Amid the Vicious Nationalism World War I. And you are also a podcast host, the What the If podcast. If
yes.
People would like to find more about this show and you online, where is the best place to do so?
Yeah, so whattheif.com is a great place to get our show. And my co-host, Philip Shane, maintains an active Twitter at whattheifshow. So you can check out not just our show itself, but lots of cool science news.
Great. And I'll include those links in the show notes for people to check that out. Matthew, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, that's all I have for today. There's probably a million other things that could be said, but I think this is a good stopping point. As always, I want to thank the Knowlton's Rangers, especially our spy masters, Bill Ivey, Joyce Normant, Tyler from Colorado, Josh Reddick, Baron Fraza, Chris from Maine, Carl from Norway, Moondoggy from Ohio, Rick Knowlton, Vic and Irene, Mike from New York, Michelle, and Marlene. I'll explain what that is in a second. If you like the show and want to help it grow, there are four easy ways for you to do it. One, like and subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice. This helps spread the word about the show. 2, join our Facebook group. Here we can keep the discussion going about new episodes, and you can talk about what you like and didn't like. And you can find this group if you just search for History Unplugged on Facebook. 3, we have an online store with t-shirts, phone covers, and other accessories featuring awesomely bad history puns that were crowdsourced by you, the audience. And you can find that if you go to teepublic.com and look for History Unplugged, or you just go to historyonthenet.com and look for our store there. 4, and this is really the best way to dive deep with History Unplugged, and that's to become one of the Knowlton's Rangers. If you know your American history, you know the Knowlton's Rangers were an elite spy and reconnaissance group in the American Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the membership program of History Unplugged. You can join at 3 levels. If you join at the level of Scout, you can hear all the episodes of History Unplugged completely ad-free and get early access to new episodes, at least a week early. If you join at the Intelligence Officer level, you get special bonus episodes, like a 10-part series on the World War II hero Audie Murphy, a multi-part series called Ottoman Lives about different people in the Ottoman Empire, and a series called Rendezvous with Death that looks at biographical profiles of Americans who went to fight in World War I before America entered the war. The last level is Spymaster, where you get all that stuff, but you also get 3 hardcover history books, Forging a President, How the Wild West Created Teddy Roosevelt, Race to the Top of the World, Richard Byrd and the First Flight to the North Pole, and The Last Fighter Pilot, the true story of the final combat mission of World War II. Another bonus is, you can choose a history topic for me to focus on for an entire episode that can go up to an hour, and I'll answer whatever question you have for me, and you get a shout out at the end of each episode. If you want to learn how to become a member of the Knowlton's Rangers, go to patreon.com/unplugged. That's patreon.com/unplugged. All right, well, that is all for my spiel. Thanks for listening to the History Unplugged podcast, from ancient Greece to the Cold War and everything else in between. See you next time.
War has played a key role in the history of the United States, from the nation's founding right down to the present. Wars made the United States independent, kept it together, increased its size, and established it as a global superpower. Hi, I'm James Early, host of the Key Battles of American History podcast. In each episode, I discuss American history through the lens of the most important battles of America's wars. To start listening now, go to parthenonpodcast.com or search Key Battles of American History on your favorite podcasting platform.